Welcome to Sunday Magazine with Liz St. John on Alice at 97.3 and RadioAlice.com.
Joining me in the studio is Steve Croft. He is a postdoctorate researcher at UC Berkeley. He's an astronomer. We're going to talk about the stars. It's the International Year of Astronomy. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Liz. It's my pleasure.
Okay, the accent is semi-British. I know you've been living here and it's corrupting your Liverpudlian accent. I was expecting the Beatles here. And tell me where you grew up and where you went to school.
I did grow up near Liverpool. I did my undergrad in London. I did a PhD in Oxford, and then I've been out here in the Bay Area for 7 years. I'm married to an American, and some people think my accent's taken the long way around through Australia, but I'm trying to kind of maintain the English accent a little bit as much as I can.
Growing up, did you think I want to be an astronomer when I grow up?
You know, I was always fascinated looking up at the night sky, and I was fascinated with how things work, sort of looking at machinery and looking at, all the kind of interesting things in science. And I guess I just never really wanted to leave school. You know, I always kind of enjoyed what I was doing. I did physics and astronomy as an undergrad and then found an interesting project to work on for my PhD. And, you know, I'm still here and still enjoying it.
While I was waiting for you to come up to the studio, I just figured, let me Google this really quick. It's just a little question since I was a kid. How big is the universe? Ta-da. So you answer it for me.
Well, that's not actually a very simple question to answer. I mean, we do know that it is very big, and one of the things that you find as you're looking further and further out in space, you realize that you're looking back and back in time because light takes a while to reach us from things that are in the distant universe. One example of this is if you go out to a very dark site, let's say you go up to the Sierras, you can see the Andromeda galaxy with the naked eye. It's our biggest near neighbor galaxy, and it's 2 million light years away. It's actually several times as big as the full moon on the sky, but it's faint, so it's kind of difficult to spot. But you're seeing light that left the Andromeda galaxy 2 million years ago that's now kind of entering your eyes as you're looking up at the sky. And as you look further and further away, you start seeing things that are as they were hundreds of millions or even billions of years ago. And the furthest back that we can see corresponds to the time that we know the Big Bang occurred, about 14 billion years ago. And so, sort of in simplistic terms, you could say that the universe is at least 14 billion light years kind of to the edge that we can see. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that, but we are sure that the universe is quite a bit bigger than that. Maybe an analogy is if you're sitting in a boat in the middle of the ocean, you know, you see your horizon all around you, but you know that that's not the edge of the world, right? That carries on beyond that. And similarly, we see the edge of the universe, but we know because it's kind of essentially smooth on those large scales that it must continue much more distant than that, and it may even be infinite. There's actually kind of really not a clear understanding of what's beyond and how far it goes.
Well, the way I finally figured it out is somehow our brains cannot get to the answer because everything here on Earth or in our immediate solar system is contained within a certain space. And that's about all. Because do you really get then how big it is? Because if it's infinite, then what's, when you get to the end, what's beyond the infinite? Anyway, we could spend a long time here,
could,
but
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
All right, so we don't exactly know how big it is, but it's big, and we can go out and we can see stars that have long since died, and we're just now receiving the information.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about what's going on at UC Berkeley. Now, you can be an undergraduate student or graduate in astronomy. So once you finish doing that, what do you do? Are there jobs? And, you know, where do all the astronomy graduates go?
There's actually quite a wide range of careers that people in astronomy go into. I have some friends. Actually, it's funny. One of them went into investment banking and was dealing with what he said, people didn't really know what credit default swaps were, and until then, of course, they've been in the news quite a bit. And so I've got one friend that was sort of partially responsible for the housing crash, I guess, and another one that was responsible for driving up the price of a barrel of oil because he was in oil trading. But there are people who go into the financial industry because they get used to dealing with computer simulations, with large amounts of data, and trying to predict what the market is going to do. And of course, as we all know, they didn't do a particularly good job of that. But I hope the astronomers were some of the better ones. I don't know.
Steve Croft is at UC Berkeley. He's researching stuff. He's an astronomer. Now, you're involved with telescopes. Tell us, there's different kinds of telescopes. Tell us what the different kinds are. What's the cutting edge? What's the biggest and best? And what are you working on?
Well, there's telescopes that can observe in different wavelengths of light. So your eyes are sensitive to visible light, obviously, but you can go right the way out to the X-rays. X-rays from space don't reach the ground, so they have to put telescopes up there in space to see astronomical objects that are emitting in X-rays, and all the way through to the other end of the spectrum with radio waves. So obviously we're broadcasting now on radio waves, and those radio waves are carrying information to people's radios. Maybe they're listening over the internet, but you know, the kind of classical picture, your radio tunes into a particular frequency and it picks up that information, and in the case of your radio, it translates it into sound. But there are astronomical sources of radio waves that we can pick up and essentially make images similar to the way your doctor might make an X-ray using X-ray wavelengths of, you know, a broken bone. We can make pictures using radio wavelengths of what these sources in the sky are emitting. And to do that, we use a radio telescope, and it basically looks like a load of satellite dishes out in the field. I'm working with the Allen Telescope Array, which is a new sort of novel design of radio telescope that we're building up in the north part of the state at Hat Creek Radio Observatory. It's just north of Lassen National Park.
It seems that these observatories and telescopes are up on the highest you can get them. What is the value of higher up? Is there less pollution to see through?
If you're observing invisible light, then really you want to be somewhere where the weather is good. So that's one reason why there's not a lot of astronomy that's actually going on in the optical in England anymore. We've started building telescopes on top of tropical mountains. And again, you don't want to be seeing through a lot of the atmosphere, so you want them to be high up. And you want to be away from other sources of light, like pollution. You know, as you know, if you look up at the sky in the Bay Area, you see fewer stars than you would do if you went out to the Sierras. And with radio wavelengths, we want to be away from big radio transmitters like radio stations or like people with cell phones or that kind of thing. And so we try and find sort of areas that are fairly isolated and undeveloped. They're actually planning to build a radio telescope that's going to be a square kilometer of collecting area, and that's going to be either in the Australian outback or in South Africa. That's kind of the next big thing. But the Allen Telescope Array that I mentioned is kind of a precursor to that. We're doing some technology development. We're also doing some really interesting science, and at the same time looking for ET. We've got a partnership with the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They have an institute down in Mountain View, and so they're kind of...
That's the SETI Institute?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. And what makes this particular configuration that you're putting together different than what's been done?
So classically, you build big antennas and you build a lot of hardware and you're focusing in on sort of a small area of the sky. I think of it as like if you see a photographer at a football game and they've got a really long lens and they're just focusing in on the action. And we're doing something that's more like landscape photography. We have kind of like a wide angle radio lens, if you like, and it's small dishes. So the dishes are about 20 feet across. They're much smaller than some of the bigger radio antennas, but we build more of them. So we have 42 dishes at the moment. We're hoping to build up to 350 if we get the funding to do so. So you can see a large area of the sky at once. It's great for surveys. It's also great for spotting things that are changing in the sky. If a supernova explodes and has, you know, a radio signal that comes after that, or if ET is transmitting, the SETI people can look at individual stars within our field of view as we're doing our radio astronomy. And so, you know, at the same time, essentially, they can be monitoring and looking for engineered signals.
You know, if we go in our backyard with a telescope that we get at one of our local stores, we can look at the moon. When you set up all these dishes, then the information comes back. Do we actually see a picture or do we see numbers? Can we look at things?
We tend to see pictures, and there are some pretty spectacular radio images that have been made. They're not the kind of thing that you would see from the Hubble Space Telescope. I think the Hubble Space Telescope has been one of the greatest ambassadors for astronomy, you know,
and
the
still
public
going.
Eye. And still going, yeah, just serviced again this year. There's some new instruments that have been put on, and you're going to see even more amazing kind of coffee table book type pictures coming out, I think, over the next few months.
All right. So you have, by the way, how is this funded, this whole telescope project that you are part of? Is that a UC Berkeley funded thing?
The Allen Telescope is kind of a novel funding mechanism. So as the name suggests, we got a lot of money from Mr. Paul Allen, who was the co-founder of Microsoft. He really helped us set it up. And it's a public-private partnership. So we have some money that's coming in from the state, and then there's money that's coming in through the Radio Astronomy Lab at UC Berkeley and through the SETI Institute in Mountain View. And really, you know, we're trying to encourage anyone who would like to make a donation, no matter how small or how large, you know, we can engage them and encourage, you know, if your listeners would like to get in touch with us, we'd be happy to hear from
you. How would they get in touch with you, by the way, in case I have an extra million and I want one of those dishes named after me? Which, if I give you a million, will you name a dish after
sure,
me?
Sure. Yeah, okay, maybe great. Even a little bit less than that.
First, get $1 million. But how would they get in touch with you? What is the best website?
So we have our website, astro.berkeley.edu, is kind of the main website of the astronomy department. And, you know, you could search for my name, Steve Croft, Berkeley, and I'll come up and I'd be happy to hear from people. And there's also the SETI Institute at Mountain View, is www.seti.org, I believe.
Steve Croft is at UC Berkeley. He's a researcher. He's an astronomer working on this fabulous new project. Someone might listen and say, hey, Steve, we got a lot of problems here on Earth. What good is it doing the human race to be out there looking around or flying missions to Mars? Not that I know what your personal take on that is, or going back to the moon. What does that do for us here?
That's a good question, and I think I'd approach this in two ways. One is that we're really kind of supporting industry and innovation. If you think of sending these rockets and space probes, you know, up into orbit, it's not like we're just shooting money up into space. We are actually paying the scientists and engineers and technicians who are building that stuff down on Earth, and so it's a really kind of important part of industry and driving that technology innovation. And the other thing is, you know, I think education is really important. You know, we've come a long way from living in caves, and a lot of that has been driven by scientific innovation. And, you know, the things that your kids learn in school were discovered at some stage by somebody who had a question and thought, hi, you know, I think I'll go out and do an experiment and try and figure out the answer to this. And I think if we stand still, you know, then we really are going to fall behind. And, you know, especially in the modern world, we need to be able to compete with other countries and to really kind of push the educational system forward. And I think the research is an important part of that.
One of the cool things that you folks do, you offer free lectures. I don't know if you always do it, but this year, the International Year of Astronomy, every month is a free lecture. And August 15th, tell us what's happening that day and where, and it's free.
Yeah, that's right. And we've been pretty excited about this lecture series. We've had some big names. Jeff Marcy and Alex Filipenko are sort of two of the big names that you may have seen sort of on TV, on programs like NOVA. And they've given some talks. The previous talks are all available on our website. You can go to astro.berkeley.edu and it's linked from there. And we have a few other speakers coming up. I'm actually one of two speakers that is going to be talking on August 15th, along with David Lindberg, who is a biology professor at the UC Museum of Paleontology. And we're going to be talking about astronomy and evolution, as well as being the 400th anniversary of Galileo's observations of the sky with his telescope. It's the 150th anniversary of Darwin's publication of his famous book on the origin of species. So we thought it'd be interesting to see, first of all, how astronomy has affected evolution with things like the asteroid that most people know probably wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, but also to discuss the evidence for evolution in astronomy. So as I was saying earlier, as you're looking further and further out in the universe, you're looking further and further back in time, so we can actually see the universe changing and evolving and getting to the stage where, you know, we start to see the evolution of stars like our sun and planets like our Earth. And some of the talks that people have been giving at the series that we've been organizing have been talking about planets around other stars, for instance. I mean, this is a really kind of fascinating growth area from the last 10 or 15 years.
August 15th on the UC Berkeley campus.
That's
where?
Right. It's in the Genetics and Plant Biology building, because we were able to find a lecture theater there that sat about 200 people. It's room 100. It's the northwest corner of the campus, and it's at 11 a.m. It's going to run for about an hour. The doors open at 10:30, and you know, we encourage people to come along, or if they can't make it, as I say, check out the video afterwards on the website.
Very cool. If someone right now either has kids that are getting ready to start, you know, prepping for college, because it takes years sort of in the planning if you have a specific college or area of study, or if someone's in high school right now and listening, what do you suggest if they're interested in the sciences? What should they be doing in high school? Obviously not goofing off. You got to do your homework and you got to get good grades, but how do you like put it together to have a good shot of getting into the science department?
I'd say focusing on science and math is important, and read a lot. you know, there's a lot of information out there on the internet, and there are magazines. I mean, especially if they're interested in astronomy, there are some popular astronomy magazines. Sky and Telescope and Astronomy are a couple of them. And there are a lot of websites out there. Go to the NASA website, you know, have a look at what people are researching, and what kind of things are available to work on. And, you know, if your parents know anybody, for example, that's working at UC, get in touch with them and sort of find out what they work on. Come along to our lectures and you know, hear what we work on and ask some questions. Most scientists are happy to have interest from people that want to find out more about what they do. And, you know, if kids want to get involved, you know, do the science fair and that kind of thing, if you have the opportunity to do that, and just, you know, follow your interests, and then hopefully you get enough background to apply to a good program and get a degree, and then you can just kind of carry on from there. That's how I became an astronomer, basically, just following my interests.
Okay, and that's at UC Berkeley. I know that sometimes some of the departments offer summer classes for high school students to sort of get involved, but if you go to the Berkeley website, you can find out a lot more. astro.berkeley.edu. You mentioned, Steve Croft is my guest from UC Berkeley, astronomer. How cool is that? You mentioned NASA. Did you ever think about being an astronaut? And, you know, you're a young guy. You look like you're in good shape. Couldn't they recruit you to be one of those science guys on a mission, although they're wrapping up the space shuttle? Would you go if invited?
If invited, sure, I would go. I mean, I think it's extremely competitive. They get thousands and thousands of applicants for just a few positions when they even put out a call, and there's rigorous training, and not all of those people get to fly.
Right. But you would do it.
I would certainly do it if I had the chance. Yeah, I mean, even knowing, you know, how risky it is, I don't know if my wife would let me do it.
Well, she, you know, that's a whole other story. But, you know, I think about that. Certainly, if they guaranteed me, no problem, you'll come back in one piece, I'd do it. Even though I think they all get nauseated. And it's, you know, and the nerves have got to be extreme. Maybe I just don't have the nervous system to be an astronaut. But there, it is risky. One, you know, tile out of place, you see what's going on. Right. But you would do it. Now, how about this? Would you rather go to the International Space Station or walk on the moon?
Oh, I'd have to go for the moon.
Absolutely. I agree. So we'll be on that mission together. We'll be going to the moon, because how cool is that?
It's pretty cool. And one of the things is that if you hear the astronauts talking about their experience on the moon, or even the astronauts that have just been up to the space station, looking down at the Earth and seeing, first of all, how fragile it is, and secondly, how you don't see national boundaries from up there. And I think it really gives people a renewed sense of perspective, which I think, you know, we could all gain from.
What have you not seen through your telescope, or other, I bet you've been around the world looking through telescopes, that you would like to see, you and other astronomers? What are you looking for that you think is out there but you haven't yet seen?
That's a great question. And I think one thing that we really hope to see during the next few years is the birth of the first galaxies. So we're getting very close back towards the Big Bang. The Big Bang created this big sea of hot gas, and then during the next few hundred million years, the first galaxies started to form, and we're just about pushing back with the sensitivity that we have to those first galaxies. And there's a telescope that's going to be going up, which is kind of the successor to the Hubble. The James Webb Space Telescope is going to be going up sometime around the middle of next decade, and that is going to help push back and really kind of catch these galaxies in the act of forming.
When that goes up, it goes out to the edge of our solar system, or where does it go that it can push it back, or does it have a bigger lens? I'm not sure. How come it will show us more than the Hubble?
Well, the Hubble is actually not that far away. The Hubble's just a few hundred miles up in low Earth orbit, and it is a very sensitive telescope, but it's not a very big telescope. Its primary mirror is about 2.5 meters across, so, you know, just what is that, you know, it's like 8 feet across, something like that. And it's just going around and around in low Earth orbit, and it has some instruments that are very sensitive and have been able to produce these amazing images. But the next way to go is, first of all, build a bigger telescope. Secondly, you want to make it sensitive to slightly longer wavelengths of light. The infrared is actually kind of where the action is at in the early universe. There's a lot of things that are enshrouded by dust particles, so you can't really see these stars forming. It's just kind of a faint glow in the infrared, and they're also very distant. And if anybody of your listeners, if they've heard about redshift, it's this idea that, you know, like a police car speeding away from you, as the pitch of the sound changes, as these galaxies are rushing away, the frequency of the light changes, and it gets more and more stretched out to the red end of the spectrum. So James Webb is going to be sensitive to these longer wavelengths of light, and it's actually going to be further away and cooled. But you don't need to kind of go out there in a rocket rocket ship, you know, to the object that you're studying. You just need a very big light bucket, essentially this mirror that collects the information.
That's going to be an exciting day when that telescope starts sending the images back to Earth. I'm sure you'll be all hanging on the edge of your seat. I think that's very, very cool. Steve Croft, astronomer from UC Berkeley. Again, free lectures. August 15th is the next one. You can go to astro.berkeley.edu and get all the information. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You can hear new interviews every Sunday morning on Alice Radio 97.3 on the FM dial. And check back to RadioAlice.com for more Sunday Magazine podcasts.